I want to read from a novel that will be published next month entitled The Terrible Threes, a sequel to The Terrible Twos. It gets worse. And by the time I write The Terrible Fours, it's going to be in a state of collapse. Anyway, I use my Afro-Native American heritage, and I have animal characters in this novel. And I thought it was appropriate to begin the novel with a quote from Johnny Carson. And he says, you know, I'm not a modernist, so you won't find me quoting St. Paul or St. Augustine or Pascal or Kafka. Okay, Johnny Carson said, when turkeys mate, they think of swans. This, I want to give you a little background on this novel. I asked somebody somebody said, what's the, how does the first, give me the plot. I said, oh, she said, I'll go read Terrible Twos. Okay. In Terrible Twos, it's been 3 years since Christmas of the Terrible Twos, a Christmas which saw amazing events transpire in the White House of Dean Clift, a former fashion model who rose from congressman to vice president and into the presidency after the death of General Walter Scott, hero of Dominica. And they went into Dominica, invaded Dominica, and found that there was only one communist. And he was sort of like a CIA plant. They filmed the whole thing in Marin County anyway. Dean Clift was a hands-off president who didn't know and didn't care to know about the activities of his advisors, Admiral Matthews, Bob Krantz, Vice President Hatchett, Jesse Hatch, and Reverend Clement Jones, the administration's spiritual advisor. Clift changed, however, after his wife, Elizabeth, the First Lady, was electrocuted while lighting the White House Christmas tree and was visited by St. Nicholas, who reveals to him the fate of former leaders who made terrible and tragic mistakes. Nicholas, out to remove his Protestant image as a buffoon in a red suit, also warns Clift of a covert operation developed by Krantz, Jones, and Matthews, codenamed Two Birds, a plan to rid America of surplus people and an African country in possession of nuclear weapons at the same time. Nobody believes Dean Clift when he discusses his vision for a nationwide. He goes on television, tells everybody Santa Claus told him that this operation was going on. So they invoke the 25th Amendment regarding presidential disability to move him from office to a private sanatorium about 50 miles from Washington. Then I introduce a character named Black Peter, which if you're German or if you're of Northern European ancestry, you know, in Europe, this Nicholas is accompanied by a companion named Black Peter. I saw this ceremony in Amsterdam, and Nicholas rides a white horse, and Black Peter rides a sports car behind him. He's the one who passes out the gifts, and he's the one that also goes on a chimney when, you know, does all the dirty work. So I introduced Black Peter into the American Christmas through this novel. Former university professor, of the University of California named Charles Jones, who wrote the definitive book on Nicholas, said the reason that you don't find Black Peter in the Nicholas or the American Christmas is because he couldn't get hotel reservations. I do the best I can, pal. Black Peter learns of the... So there's an imposter, Black Peter, and he comes... The real Black Peter emerges from an island of Guinea, an island beneath the Caribbean Ocean, to challenge this other Peter, who's been living underground Manhattan since the riot that happened during a Christmas party at Madison Square Garden, which is precipitated by Jack Frost and his goons. Jack Frost works for the toy manufacturers, Christmas card merchants, okay? Nance Saturday, a wannabe detective, and it goes on and on. I'll just read from the first chapter here. This is from The Terrible Threes, and... the character here is Nance Saturday, who's an incompetent detective. Doesn't solve the case in The Terrible Twos. As a matter of fact, one of my friends, a feminist critic, said, what kind of detective is this? The clues are always getting ahead of him. So in this novel, I have the clues getting ahead of him. I'd learn from critics. And it says, I'll read some of this. Nance Saturday agreed with Genesis, where it said that man should not be alone. He spent a lot of time interacting with his electronic playmates. He was watching his ex-wife's show. She was interviewing a woman whose hairstyle resembled that of a baby chick's. And she says, Thanksgiving is just an excuse for all the misogynists and femophobes of the country to keep women over hot stove. And in the shopping aisles, searching for bargains in turkey, the American men are fully capable of obtaining their own cranberry sauce. Most of them don't know how to carve a turkey, and so the woman must also perform this chore. And so when people wish me a happy Thanksgiving under the circumstances, I wonder what there is to be so thankful about. She was wearing a white shirt buttoned at the collar, tight, shiny black pants, no socks and black shoes. She folded her arms and crossed her legs. She then lit a cigarette. "I agree with you, Becky," Virginia said. "My ex-husband didn't even earn enough money to buy a turkey. He was always doing odd jobs. I paid his way through a year of law school, but then he dropped out. But now I found a man who really knows how to carve the turkey. He's sensitive, he's considerate, and he's 10 years younger than I am." Nance got up and turned off the television set to think that he spent those years sleeping next to a woman who would later tell all their secrets to a nationwide audience. Her ratings were as high as those of her only rival, Okra Hippo, who had to be moved into the studio for appearances on a network by Piano Movers. He switched, bound to make me friends, right? He switched to another channel. An Asian American man was speaking heatedly to an Asian American woman. The man was furious. The camera kept cutting away to the audience of mostly women who were giving the man a cool response. The woman calmly sat in a chair, ignoring her debating opponent's fury. She was wearing a black suit and a man's tie. The moderator asked her a question. Nance turned off the audio, and she says, "I think Mr. Hamamoto's argument is absurd. To suggest that the American government owes the Japanese American community reparations. As usual, Mr. Hamamoto ignores the facts. He speaks of internment. Identification came on the screen. Michiko Mizuni. This is a Japanese woman who wanders through the novel searching for the great blonde wig. Michiko. He fails to distinguish between internment and relocation. Only a few thousand Japanese Americans were actually interned, but speaking to the logic question, but which was the worst, the relocation and the internment? I say that the United States did Japanese American women a great favor. They removed them from homes in which they were being brutalized by Japanese American men, a far greater imprisonment next to which relocation and internment were minor inconveniences. So instead of receiving $20,000, Japanese Americans should be donating that amount to our generous government." The audience erupted into wild applause. The camera cuts to the man. He was shaking his head sadly. Nance didn't care about the battle between the sexes that had spilled over from the 80s into the 90s. As far as he was concerned, he was AWOL from the war. He was keeping his to himself and not sticking it nowhere. The mysterious black Russian he'd been seen since he and Virginia separated had also left. He remembered the last night of their lovemaking. She yelled out something that sounded like, "Yabatsa, Yabatsa." He was on her like a coyote. He was on her like a coyote on a chicken that night. Limbs were flying, and the heels of feet were facing the ceiling. Their buttocks were rolling, gyrating. At one point, when their rhythm was perfectly synchronized, he gave a nasty shift like the pot-bellied flamenco dancer he'd once seen do. And she shrieked like someone who walked into the kitchen in Florida on Sunday morning and found an alligator on the floor. It's my tribute to Faulkner. He has long similes, you know. It's a tribute to modernism. I'm not against them. The cognac, there were lots of French kisses and Russian fingers. The cognac had spilled on the floor. They were so weak that they almost missed a Soviet airliner that was to return her to her family in Kiev. She was wearing a black dress decorated with red roses, black 40s hat, and she carried a black handbag. Their sporadic love making had become victim of yet another liberalizing trend in Russian politics, the 1980s trend having been ruthlessly repressed towards the end of the decade, profit, right? She was out with her relatives because she wanted to claim her charter heritage while they wanted to be thought of as European. A friend of the family who had dinner with them drank all the stoli they'd ordered, ate the red cabbage and sturgeon, had returned to Kiev to tell her family that she had a lover. They were very provincial people, commented on books they hadn't read and performances they hadn't seen. He thought he remembered her telling him that they were mathematicians. They had a DACA housekeeper and a chauffeur and didn't want to blow it. He didn't seem to get along with the parents of the women he dated. Virginia's mother took the cake. Virginia said it wasn't until she was 35 that her mother stopped beating her with an iron cord. When her relatives visited them when they were married, he always wondered why they kept on their trench coats. One night he awoke and found that she wasn't sleeping beside him. He drove to the motel where her family was staying and peeked into the window of the suite they'd rented. Some of his personal items lay on the table, and her sister, the one with the slow rate of metabolism, was plucking a long strand of the Russian's lady's coarse black hair from one of his shirts marked Exhibit A. Virginia was crying. They seemed to be building up a case against him. That wasn't the only cause, but he remembered in the series of arguments they had before they broken up, he said that she was still shackled by her family. He dated a series of European-American women, ranging from the California beauties you see modeling bikinis in Sports Illustrated, Herb Gold's favorites, to the black-haired, arty types who listened to Laurie Anderson and were into BAM. Virginia and her friends were right about European-American women. They spent a lot of time tossing their hair. While vacationing in the Caribbean, he visited a museum where he came upon a painting of ancient Carib woman. Lust in her eyes as she stared at a pig was immaculate. He fell in love with her fat lips and shiny hair. She had small breasts and her legs looked as though she spent a lot of time running out of craters. Another painting showed her spearing a wild boar. Coincidentally, he ran into a woman who looked just like her at a gallery opening on the Lower East Side. She said that she was from Flippuccino, or from a small island in the Pacific called the Flippuccines. They began to date, and for a while they were as happy as two sailors dancing in a movie with Ann Miller. Her mother found out about it. She began to send strange envelopes to him. Some were filled with parts of birds, and a large envelope covered with stamps with pictures of men wearing the kind of hairstyles that influenced the punkers, he found the ear of a large rat. He told her about it, and she said that her mother always sent horrible material to her lovers and that her last boyfriend, Richard, had disappeared. One night she called to tell him that her mother had flown in from the Flippuccino Islands and wanted to have dinner with them. That was fine with him because after dinner, maybe they'd go to her apartment and put on some Marvin Gaye records. Marvin Gaye would have loved her because she was a real healer. What Martin Luther King Jr. would have called a doctor. Didn't get that one, huh? The kind that would have sent JFK with his bad back to a chiropractor. She did all the work. All he had to do was lay there. She may not have been the kind of woman that you found behind every great man, but she certainly was next to him in a variety of other ways. At dinner, her mother said that she didn't see anything on the menu that appealed to her and requested that the waiter bring her the names of the diners. He didn't get the import of this incident until later when his date went to the ladies' room and he was left alone with her mother. Her mother didn't say anything but glared at him for a long time. This made him feel uncomfortable and shifted in his seat. What was taking her daughter so long in the bathroom? Finally, her mother pulled out a huge basket made of straw with a ship design on it and removed something. It was a miniature head about the size of a chestnut. An old wrinkled chestnut, a prune. It was the head of a man. Richard, he said weakly. The old woman nodded. He went out to the parking lot and emptied his dinner on the ground. He never ate shrimp again. That's when he entered a new celibacy period. Orifices of the 90s were like those of the 80s anyway. They were covered with do not enter signs. No wonder Cupid was armed. Okay. It goes on and on like that, you know. On and on.